our discussion with Andrew Colvin about the Mothman. And as we have learned, the Mothman story first came to prominence based on events in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where a bridge collapsed. John Keel, the original investigator of the Mothman story, writes in his complete guide to mysterious beings, Point Pleasant, West Virginia is a typical window area. There are hundreds of others throughout the United States, each marked by continuous UFO activity over long periods of time, bizarre monster sightings, and the mysterious comings and goings of unusual persons. It's completely erroneous to blame the collapse of the rickety old silver bridge on flying saucers or men in black, but the intense UFO activity in the area on the night of the disaster does suggest some intangible relationship. Again, Keel continues, our in-depth investigation in several other windows in the United States have uncovered manifestations and phenomena identical to the things we found in Point Pleasant. When the flying saucers arrive, they bring with them strange invisible forces, frightening screams in the night, and luminous phantoms. What, if any, connection is there? What common denominator is there between Mothman and these other so-called paranormal phenomena? We jump into that discussion with Andrew Colvin right after this break on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew Colvin, could you talk for a couple of minutes about some of the other phenomena that seem to come along with Mothman? I mentioned sort of a laundry list there in the break, leading up to the break, but why don't you tell us some stories about the kinds of things witnesses have told you, other entities, creatures, mysteries, appearances that seem to come along with the territory?
Yeah, it's a long list. I made a list of them a while back, and I don't know if I can remember all of them tonight, but there's, you know, even in my neighborhood, you can find just about every thing that could be seen. You've got a Flatwoods monster-y kind of thing with a hood, which appears to change from gender, from male to female. And this is kind of an old Patrick Harper, I think it's Patrick, did a lot of research on that and found that this goes way back. This gender-bending thing, and it's often related to fairy forts, which are window areas that are on ley lines, natural outcroppings that where lights appear, where these balls of light that seem to have intelligence, that seem to respond to you, are located. And we did have that. We had a lady right there where we all saw Mothman. There was a lady living there who said she saw these lights all the time. There's a Native American kind of thing that can appear as three men, three Indian guides. There's this shimmery things that we saw. I guess you could throw aliens, you know, the gray alien in there, because Tommy, the guy that had that original 911 vision, was saying that he was in touch with the space intelligences and that they were these 3-4 foot high, greenish, it's the little green men thing. You know, there really seems to be something with that in the Native American lore, especially. They call them the Pukwudgies or the Nunahi. In Hawaii, they're called the Menheyun. And they sort of seem to occupy this space in between physical reality and another dimension. It's almost like they're holograms, but at times can become physical as they're passing through our dimension. They're physical for a short time. It's very hard to wrap your head around. But we had those. We had, Mothman, cigar-shaped UFOs, flying saucers, Black Panthers. It's called Old Scratch in West Virginia. It's this shape-shifting Black Panther that can appear as a woman. I know I'm missing a few here.
Well, Sasquatch, Bigfoot. Kind of Bigfoot kind of thing, right?
Bigfoot, definitely in our neighborhood. That's called the Braxton County Monster. Sometimes people get that confused with the Flatwoods Monster. The Virgin Mary. I don't think anybody's seen Jesus yet, but, that hooded figure kind of looks like a monk.
What about animal mutilations? Anything like that? I didn't see that in your book. At least I don't remember reading it.
No, we didn't have that in my neighborhood, but Point Pleasant had 3 German Shepherds. that were killed. And, you know, it's interesting because I found a reference. I've been studying the XX group, which is the British intelligence group that was tracking the Nazis all around. And they had a corollary in the U.S. called the X2 group. And those guys were all trained in how to kill dogs by stretching their legs out if they attack and breaking their sternum. And it may be that those dogs were killed by these agents and left. And then, you know, maybe they were actually flying around in saucers, these guys. And because at least one of these dogs was found in a circle that looked like a saucer had landed. But I think in general, I think the cattle mutilations, you know, those were sort of outed in around 1980 by David DeWitt, who was a scientist who said, you know, this is a typical way to find out mineral resources. You know, the minerals leach up to the plants, and then the cattle eat them. And if you kill the cattle right where they stand and rush the meat back to a freezer, you can study the meat and find out what's under the ground. And he named a bunch of different power companies and that were in on this, oil companies and so forth. And that got all pushed under the rug by various people. And, you know, that's my feeling about the cattle mutilations. And then with crop circles, I think it's a similar thing. I think that those are probably being designed by satellites. You know, you plug your design into the satellite and the laser, you know, makes a design on the ground, and then they build a whole lore around it. And that explains why the crop circles got more and more intricate over time. At first, they, you know, were kind of clumsy and didn't have it down. But, you know, now they're amazingly intricate, mind-blowingly intricate. And then they sort of entered in this bogus theory that guys could make them with boards and stuff, just, I think, to confuse the issue. But these are, they're just practice sessions, I think, where they're using Star Wars technology.
Well, help me figure this out. We could talk about crop circles and mutilations all night just by themselves, and I could give you some rival theories about those. But let's stick with your list of characters here that have shown up in association with Mothman or in the same way. I guess, obviously, we're going to be guessing about this, but it's a chicken and egg kind of a question. Does Mothman come in first and then all the other stuff happens? Does he appear in an area where it's already a hot spot of other paranormal activity? You know, in what order, and is there a connection between them, I wonder? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, you know, this is an ancient entity, and it appears over these areas that once had Indian mounds or are at crossroads of ley lines, and this has been going on forever, but it just so happens that they built a lot of these different facilities on these spots, the chemical companies and so forth, so you're just going to have a lot more Mothman sightings there. And I think Mothman is fulfilling a role of some sort where he's trying to warn us about pollution, basically. That this is, you know, the thing that can really, really decimate us, and we need to do something about it. I think the other stuff just, some of it's conspiracy stuff that's, you know, Men in Black activity going on. But it is an energy force that I think can change shape and appear in different ways.
So maybe all of these things are the same thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, it gets pretty cosmic at that point. But, you know, sort of like the Buddhist idea that reality is just one thing, that everything is an emanation of. Everything's connected. Every light particle is communicating with others, and so anything can actually appear anywhere. And when you get into the whole mound symbology, you start seeing these different ancient symbols showing that, for instance, Atum in Egyptian is the birth of man from a mound. There's something about mounds that can manifest imagery and perhaps even actual life. I mean, it could be that if we get wiped out by a cataclysm, that somehow life pops up again from these mounds. And, you know, this whole thing about when you view atoms, when you observe light particles, they know that you're observing them. It could be that these different creatures are trying to manifest, and when people see them, people are collapsing the wave. They don't want these beings to exist, and so the being sees you observing it in that way and goes away. But what if you weren't there? What if there weren't people to observe and collapse the wave? Well, stuff might just start manifesting. I mean, that may be how we keep surviving all of these different collisions with, you know, comets and asteroids and floods. I mean, there's clearly the Earth has been, you know, practically destroyed many times, according to the geological record.
I'm intrigued by the stories you tell in the book about shape-shifting. You know, you already mentioned how Mothman would turn into something else, the Golden Boy. There's an example of a UFO that turns into a Mothman.
Yeah.
That's why I raised the idea that maybe all of these entities, all of these different manifestations are, in fact, the same thing. They're just taking different shapes. And I guess if you can change shape at will and how you appear, whether it's physically changing shape or just changing in our heads how we're perceiving it, I guess we really have no idea what this thing or these things look like anyway.
Yeah, and while that is true, it actually kind of blinds people, I think, to additional possibilities. I agree with you that is true. However, some of the UFOs, I think, are man-made, and it's because whoever developed them, and I actually think Tesla probably came up with it first because he clearly was trying to do that, he was using ancient symbols to do it. So in a way, he was tapping into that phenomenon that has always existed to come up with a synthetic version. So there really are, I think, real UFOs and synthetic ones. And it gets really confusing, and you almost have to take each case on a case-by-case basis to decide if this is a real UFO or a synthetic one.
I covered some of the same ground. Dr. Colm Kelleher and I wrote a book called Hunt for the Skinwalker, which looks at the weird activity at the Bigelow Ranch in Utah. Of course, it has a lot of the same kinds of things. It has just a whole big, long laundry list of paranormal phenomena all concentrated in one area. It appears at different times in different guises to different people. It seems to have the ability to shapeshift. In fact, that's where the Skinwalker story comes from. The Native Americans in the area had talked about this shapeshifter entity that lives in that property. A lot of the same kinds of basic stories that are told by you in relation to Mothman appear here. And it makes you wonder whether it's a trickster phenomena, whether it is meant to mess with our heads, whether it is meant to lead us to some greater truth or make us think outside the box and realize that the world is a far more mysterious place than we've been led to believe.
Yeah, it keeps you on your toes. You really can't just stick with a set paradigm, because it might be the trickster phenomenon. Although I think as with regard to the harbinger of doom aspect, with regard to pollution and nuclear power and stuff, I do think that's a good thing. I don't think there's anything bad about wanting to move away from those technologies and into something more clean like solar or wind. So, I thought your book was really good too, and you really explored some of the conspiratorial aspects. And it kind of reminded me of the DFED enigma. I don't know if you've ever read that book by
No.
Ted Holliday.
No.
You should check that one out, because it's very similar to your book, and just as weird. And but it takes place in England, though.
Well, here's what intrigues me most, and which I have no answer for, and maybe you can address. And it sort of touches on what you just talked about, how, you know, these entities are forming, and once we see them, you know, just like observing an atom affects it, just the act of observing affects matter. A tree falling in the forest, do we hear it? Does it make sound if there's nobody there? It seemed to me that things at the ranch in Utah, and maybe some of the things there in Point Pleasant that you've explored, are performances, that they, only certain people see them at certain times. The force, the energy, the entity, whatever the heck it is, it decides who gets to see it, under what conditions, in what form, for reasons that we can only guess at. but obviously meant to affect us or have an impact on us in some way. Maybe it feeds off the energy. Maybe it wants us to help us evolve. I don't know. I mean, it opens up a whole lot of really interesting questions.
Yeah, I think they sort of opened up that door quite a bit in Point Pleasant when they built those domes, those TNT domes over, you know, the center of the Indian village. You know, that mound shape is key. If you look back at the native lore, actually the Western, some of the Western writings about the Indians from the 1700s, you'll find that there were instances where shamans would build a dome, a domed teepee, to go in there and tell the future. You build this certain shape, and it somehow reflects the energy in, and they write about sparks flying out the top as the guys in there seeing the future and telling the tribe where to hunt and where to find food, you know, who's going to get sick and all this kind of stuff. And that's happened to me a couple of times. I built a tent and then immediately got involved in some kind of weird thing happening where in one case we saw an invisible something moving the brush, but there was nothing there. In another case, in Virginia, built a tent, got settled in there, and then all of this screaming started happening all around us that was blood-curdling, and we were so terrified. We sat in there with a gun, clutching it all night. You know, we were afraid to do anything.
Screaming, like a human voice screaming?
Yeah. Yeah, baby screams. I mean, and that could be, you know, could be mountain lions or, but, you know, there are banshees that are said to mimic baby screams and women's screams and things. But those domes, you know, in a way were mimicking Indian mounds, which themselves were often constructed in a certain way. They would have mica linings, which is a very dense reflective material. And then they've actually found skeletons in the mounds that were in a meditation position as if the person decided. And the Buddhists in Tibet do this. They die by meditating and slowly suffocate themselves. And it could be that when these shaman expired in the mounds in the meditation position, that it preserved their energy somehow in the mound. And then later, somebody breaks into the mound and that energy escapes and causes these visions somehow.
Wow. I do want to talk to you about the Native American connection in a little bit more detail, because it's one of the things that we were able to research as part of that book project I mentioned, is that you look around the country looking for paranormal hotspots, and Point Pleasant, I guess, could certainly be count as that. The Utah Ranch would be another one. Yakima, Washington, Sedona, California, Dulce, New Mexico, all of them with strong, strong Native American presence now and through history. And somehow that seems to be a factor in where these intense hotspots of strange stuff pop up. So I want to get into that with you about whether you have a theory on how that is connected. And then I want to return to the 9/11 story, because you and your friends see this vision as kids, and later it comes to pass. But there is additional information that you mentioned in the book, psychic kind of research from our colleague Dean Radin, that I think is really intriguing. So we'll continue our conversation with Andrew Colvin, and then in the next hour we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions about the Mothman. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, we jump right back into the Mothman mystery. And then at the top of the hour, we open up the phone lines with your questions for our guest. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew Colvin, have you found other spots as hot in the Mothman area as, say, Point Pleasant? I mean, does it pop up in the United States in anything comparable to what you've seen there?
Oh, boy. It seems to be all over. I've just sort of been focusing on my area because, you know, life's short and there's so much to it that I can't cover them all. But if you go to any major city, you'll find the same kind of pattern. You'll find mounds. They'll maybe have one or two still left, but you can, you know, if you do any research at all, you'll see that there were, even in California, you know, mounds all over San Jose and Santa Clara. And they've been torn down, and they'll often build convention centers, schools, chemical plants again, those kinds of public kind of or corporate places over them, and or churches. You know, that's the other thing is that a lot of our older churches are built above, right on top of some previous structure that was there. In the case of a lot of the Catholic churches, they, you know, there's these reports that under the mounds there were structures where they would go under there and they would mimic the shape of the mound under the ground, which led to the, a lot of our older Catholic churches having a mithraeum underneath, which is an arched, sort of rounded dome vaulted thing under there, the catacombs or whatever. And that, if you look at Jung's Red Book, you'll see some drawings in there of, that sort of indicate that there used to be a more of a matriarchal religion. And you see that in the Egyptian history, too. And then it sort of morphed into a patriarchal thing. You had Isis change into Mary. And you'll see a lot of the names of these spots where things happen. Will have a certain prefixes and syllables in them that are that have this older meaning, like Ra, Ray, anything with Ray in it. That's the older name for Ra. Ra was originally Ray, which is female, and somehow it got switched around. Anything with Ga in it usually refers to Earth or Gaia. Mon refers to a mound. Like the town I grew up in was called Mound in the old days, and apparently it had the biggest array of mounds there were and had some enormous circular structures that would fit the Great Pyramid into exactly.
Huh.
So there's a, it seems as if there's a mimicking of the Egyptian stuff happening in America, and that gets into that whole ancient history thing that I've been tracking. You know, who were the original inhabitants? Because the Indians say that they didn't build these structures. They appear to have been built by people that had some knowledge of what was happening in Egypt. And, in fact, may have been Egyptians who migrated over, like the Montauk Indians on Long Island, who claimed to actually be descendants of the pharaohs. And my family has some tie-ins in various ways. We married into the Montauks, the first Colvin who came over in 1700s, his son married a Montauk, and all four of my, you know, family lines have Native and or African American bloodlines, because there's some real intermingling going on there. At some point, it gets hard to tell what's Native American and what's African. Or Northern African.
Well, it's sort of what you're mentioning with the mounds sort of touches on where I was heading with the conversation, and what I mentioned leading into the break is the Native American connection. You touched on it briefly before. It just seems like you look for a paranormal hotspot, UFOs, Sasquatch, mutilations, all these kinds of things, where you look for a spot where all those things are mixed into the into one area. You find a strong Native American presence. I mean, I guess you can make the argument that all Native Americans were everywhere on this continent, but that is not entirely true in terms of concentration of historical settlements and things of that sort. So do you agree that that connection seems to have something to do with paranormal hotspots that pop up now?
Absolutely, and the Ohio Valley is a key one. We were, when I was just in Pittsburgh, we found the same thing there. We went to see this mound, McKee's Rocks Mound, which I don't know if there's any other mounds left, but we went there, and that one doesn't seem to be there either. They're calling the hillside there the mound, but it's obvious that the mound from older pictures that that mound isn't there anymore. And what's there now is a chemical plant. We actually went in and talked to the geologist, and he was telling us that the Ohio Valley is really the drainage center of America, not the Mississippi, really. He was like, and sort of felt like that the Mississippi should be called the Ohio, because the Ohio is it's draining all the way from New York, you know, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, West Virginia, Virginia. All those are ending up in the Ohio, and then the Mississippi is really kind of a small river until it meets the Ohio. So that's anything, you know, there's a lot of these spots are on the Ohio, and you can really, but they're everywhere. I just know from studying the Ohio that there's a plethora of them there. And they, who knows if these mounds are even built synthetically? It could be that they're natural somehow, because there are birds in New Guinea, and there's probably other ones that I haven't found yet that build enormous mounds. And that would explain how some of the different materials in the mounds appear to have come from hundreds of miles away. And it might even explain why we're seeing birdmen around mounds. Maybe there's some cosmic. But my son has a theory that there's some cosmic connection between birds and men. And then you do see these crazy stories from ancient times. You know, the Nephilim and all that, where we supposedly mated with birdmen and all that. It gets a little speculative, because who can read Sumerian? You know, how do we really know what happened?
You mentioned your son. Your son has an interest in these topics. Now, tell me this: is this sort of a, you know, it's in the alien abduction scenarios? You know, it's passed from family to family member, generation to generation. Is there anything like that with Mothman? Does he, since you have an interest and you saw him, is your son gonna have his own experiences?
Well, I had some strange things happen when he was conceived and when he was born. You know, I definitely knew I was getting strange visions and things. And he's actually the person who found this thing in the window. We never would have known about this thing in the window if it weren't for him. He was, he was almost three. And he looked at this picture as I was pulling them out of the envelope that my sister had sent me. Just sent me a bunch of random photos. And he points right to the window and he goes, "Garuda." And I had never talked to him about the Garuda before.
Wow.
And other people were there who saw this, and I'm not making it up. And ever since then, he has amazing ideas. He's always finding out little things. And he went into a long explanation, which I filmed once, about how we got our religion from the Egyptians, and somehow bird consciousness was transferred into human consciousness and the whole thing. And I have no idea where he got it. He was about four at that time.
I want to switch gears for a second back to almost where we started. Your interest in Mothman, of course, began when you were a youngster and you had a vision, you and your friend in the backyard, of what turned out to be 9/11. After the events of 9/11, you started doing your more serious research into the Mothman story and backtracking and finding witnesses. It turns out, as one of the most interesting parts of your book, I thought, was reference to other sort of psychic research that would tend to support the idea that there was a psychic component to 9/11, that the human consciousness in general knew that something was coming.
Yeah, you were talking about Dean Radin's statistical, I guess you could call it, research using, you know, millions of, or thousands at least, of people randomly giving their ideas over the internet about what they were dreaming about or sensing. And I guess he does this all the time, and he's putting these through a computer. And I'm trying to remember exactly. It seemed as if there was an escalation about a week prior to 911, but then right for the, like, a day or two before, there was nothing. There was it was almost as if it disappeared. It was like the eye of a hurricane. That was my impression. You know, the eye of a hurricane is quiet. And I think I mentioned that it seemed as if it's sort of shifted from everybody having a little bit of terrorism in their minds to most people, you know, that vacuum came in, everybody sort of left most people's minds, but then a few people got it really intensely and had these incredible visions of it, you know, as it was happening or before or right after.
right before, and some of the messages, too hot to handle, blasting, is the coast clear, White House gone in the blink of an eye, scald, man's folly, surging, palace, let's see, the tall structure, volcanic ash plume. These are all images that people record prior to 9/11 that Dean Radin come up with.
And didn't he say that the probability of there being a drop off like that right before was what, like 1 in 5 billion or something? It was some incredible number.
Yeah. Yes, I don't see it here. 1.8 million to 1, I think, is what it is. The odds against something like that happening, the kind of drop off that he reflected on. So it suggests that there's some sort of a flow of information on some level that was reaching people's brains that we can't quite explain. Maybe it's the same sort of flow of information that hit your brain as a youngster.
Yeah, because these ripples go out forward and backward in time, I think, because that would explain that strange. And I wonder about that vision I had about the drowning, and that was what I got out of it, was that you can see something from the past or from the future.
I thought one of the other interesting things that you bring up in the book is this concept of the void, which I think comes from Buddhists way back. Can you explain what you mean by the void and how it relates to what we're talking about tonight?
Yeah, the void, let's see, it's what underlies, you know, we were talking about light particles. It's almost where magnetism exists, the void. It's an area where light and dark don't really matter because it's prior to light and matter, light and dark. And it's symbolized in various ways. The center of the earth is sometimes referred to as the void, the vril, the black sun. But the Buddhists see it as enlightenment, as a mixture of the void and bliss. Because the void is the most scary thing you can think of, really. If you think about being totally alone, that's about as bad as it gets, right? So the Buddhists like to meditate on that and somehow become comfortable enough with it that you can experience bliss out of that nothingness. Because then you've conquered your fears, you've conquered death in a sense. And the Birdman, you know, does relate to that. Especially in the Thunderbird symbols.
You also, in the book, you get into something a little more pleasant, I guess, as a possibility other than the void, is that you talk about these entities like Mothmen shepherding people around as spirits of the dead after they're gone.
Yeah, as well as the Thunderbird and the Garuda, too. The Garuda is the master of sound. And they all relate to lightning, which can cause instant death. Sound, the spaces between. The Garuda represents the spaces between things, which is the void. And that's one of the things you want to meditate on. In Asian culture, in the East, they meditate more on the void, things between spots, the points, the space between points, and we tend to, in the West, look at the points. It's helpful. If we could get more of that going in our society, it would, it would tend to make us less materialistic, because the materialistic person is always going to be looking at the thing that they want. It's a thing. They're not really thinking about the process. The processes that you have to go through to get things done. It's like that adage, it's not whether you win, it's how you play the game. How you play the game is the void. It's that space in between losing and winning and starting the game and ending the game. So I think there's very, very beneficial things to learn here.
Like what?
Well, that just that. I mean, looking at the ways we can not be so goal-oriented, but more people-oriented. You know, how are our relationships versus how are we going to get something?
That the journey is more important than the destination.
Yeah, yeah, the path.
Right.
In Buddhist terms.
The one of the things that you get into, and I think one of the most attractive parts of the book, is this material from Kiel that I had not read before. You've dug up some stuff that is not widely published or distributed. He makes a reference in here, and I don't mean to catch you off guard, but it's on page 248 of your book. He makes a reference to the idea that mind control might be involved. Kiel personally knew of several cases where young, bright West Virginia children were being tracked for future government service, and the same thing had happened at my elementary school in Mound, is what this quote is from. It's a letter from Kiel to Colin Wilson, or I can't tell if it's you writing this or not.
He wrote that letter to Wilson, and then I probably threw that in about my school.
Right.
Yeah, we had five or six genius kids we tested as at genius level or close to it. And one explanation I have for that is that maybe somehow we were the reincarnated monks or something, because we were all born around the time of the great genocide in Tibet when they were killing off the monks. And I've heard from different, I was in a Buddhist order for about a year, and I've heard various tales about how they were actively trying to reincarnate in America in order to fight the Chinese. It's a very interesting idea. They think outside the box over there. That's about as far as outside the box you can get. But, you know, maybe that's one explanation.
This idea of being tracked for future government service, were you tracked?
I don't think I was, because I was into art. Harriet definitely says she was, that they pulled her in there many times and did some more testing on her. Another guy there has become a physicist who's, you know, he's worked with certain big companies over the years, and I don't know if he was tracked or not. I don't know if he what his thoughts are on that exactly, but Harriet definitely felt she was. And I mean, in America today, I mean, we're all tracked, increasingly tracked, but yeah, they were definitely looking into kids that could help the national security apparatus, and we had a ton of different, especially in Harriet's family, lots of her family ended up, you know, working for government agencies and things.
All right. Andrew Colvin, our conversation with you about Mothman continues. We'll open up the phone lines. Bruce Springsteen, a rocker but a dark song, further on up the road, takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.